Welcome to this special series of Moneyball Medicine focused on AI, machine learning, and analytics applied to drug discovery and development. This special series was recorded as part of the AI Application Summit produced by Quarry Lane Partners this October in Boston, Massachusetts. I'm your host, Harry Glorikian. In this series, I will interview different speakers from the event and we will hear their experiences. We will dive into the challenges and opportunities they're facing and their predictions for years to come. Welcome to Moneyball Medicine. What if the introduction of artificial intelligence into drug discovery allowed us to create a true learning loop? The idea that for the first time, all decisions can be guided by all preceding successes and failures is a profound thought. My next guest and his company have been building a system with artificial intelligence algorithms that are attempting to do just that. Imagine being able to predict pharmacokinetics and toxicity profiles of compounds. This unique ability to learn from all past programs to inform every future chemical design and candidate selection decision could have a profound impact on the future of drug discovery and how the industry evolves going forward. My guest today, Guido Lanza, is the president and CEO of Numerate, which he co-founded in 2007 along with a team of computer scientists and drug hunters. Their vision was to change the discovery paradigm through AI, to unlock inaccessible emerging biology, and to build a platform capable of learning from all previous data and mistakes in the industry. As the company has grown, they evolved their business model from being primarily a medicinal chemistry service provider for pharma to an AI-driven company with both major pharma alliances and a pipeline of first-in-class therapeutic programs. Guido is the author of 10 scientific publications and inventor with 4 issued patents. He received his BA in molecular and cell biology and integrative biology from the University of California, Berkeley, and an MS in bioinformatics from the University of Manchester, UK. Guido, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So Guido, we probably have a lot in common. My wife went to UC Berkeley and I actually grew up in San Francisco, went to school there also. So, great meeting of a fellow Bay Area individual.
No, likewise. Yeah, it seems like ages ago when I was at Berkeley playing with the early bioinformatics software, but that's like a lifetime ago, especially in such a rapidly evolving space.
Guido, can you tell our listeners a little about Numerate and what you guys do?
Sure. So I think thank you for the introduction, and I think you captured some of this very nicely. When we were starting Numerate, we were looking at exactly the problem as you framed it, right? Which is, I look at the PHRMA report every year, and I see that the only thing that changes is the font, and that the attrition rates stay effectively the same. And coming from a bioinformatics background, at least my view was that all these interesting targets that were going to come out of genomics were going to run up against a process that may have been well suited when the fifth statin can make you $1 billion, but that was going to be increasingly ill suited to go after, I think, exciting new biology. So really, that was what drove us to start working on this problem. I think what we quickly realized was that coming up with active compounds and using AI to do that, or we used to call machine learning, before the AI summer we're now in, was certainly achievable, but that the really hard part was more around the optimization, was around how do I solve the multi-objective problems that differentiate really an active compound from a drug. And so we've really spent the majority of our time focusing on those parts of the problem and really building a team of, I would say that is where both the drug hunters and the AI researchers are bought into the other group's skill set and value add. And so in a way, the way to think about Numerate, I think, is it's this half man, half machine, where there's a whole process to go after some of these very challenging drug design problems.
Now, you know, 2007, I mean, that's, you know, you're talking early days. You know, what was the model back then? And you know, I feel like it's, you know, two guys in a computer and let's see what we can sort of put together on this. But what was it like back then?
Yeah, so actually, I mean, if I want to date myself, we started working on this even before that. And so, and it was in the context of a different company where we developed a lot of the prototype technology that ended up then evolving into what we built here. But really, I mean, what we saw was that there was a convergence, I think, of three, well, fundamentally three things. The first was, you know, we knew somebody was going to build a cloud service. I mean, we'd spent so long building air conditioning, powering Beowulf clusters. And it was clear that somebody was going to come up with something that was good. At the time, it wasn't exactly clear that Amazon was going to be the winner, although we jumped on that very early and were, I think, one of the biggest users in the early days of AWS. So this idea that the compute would be effectively infinite and that what we would be able to do is really take a step back and say, you know, what's the problem I want to solve, rather than, you know, what is the iron I have and I need to get my chemist an answer back before he forgets what the question was, which is typically about a week, right? So, you know, now I can remove those constraints and think, if I have infinite compute, how do I want to solve the problem? And really, the cloud was going to let us do that. So we were building the system to be cloud native and really to think about, you know, again, how do I prioritize the compounds that I eventually make and test? And by doing, you know, by having it on the cloud, it means that I can look at, you know, essentially infinite spaces of chemistry with a lot of, you know, some very detailed simulations for each of the compounds, right? That was one aspect. I think the second was, you know, when I started thinking about this problem, I'd have to sit there and download PDFs and draw in the compounds by hand that were going to make up my training set. But thanks to efforts like GVK in India, for example, they effectively had digitized all of the data in medicinal chemistry going back to the 1950s. So we got to build and test against, you know, human knowledge in medicinal chemistry from the get-go. And I think the third is, you know, there was a machine learning revolution that was less advertised in our space than this sort of deep learning revolution that's going on now. And certainly, you know, resulted in many of the companies that are the big players in Silicon Valley today. And many of those approaches, you know, I think really started to blossom in the early 2000s or, you know, right around then. And many of those approaches are probably more relevant to the problems in drug discovery than even some of the you know, the approaches that people are trying today. And so it was sort of a convergence of algorithms, compute, and data that we saw coming. And of course, it was also at a time when nobody cared because everybody was investing in primarily in development compounds. Platform companies were not a sexy play for investors. I would say chemistry even less. And so, you know, we had to figure out a path through business model space during the AI winter so that when, you know, when people started paying attention, we would have, you know, the most validation, the most advanced platform, and we'd be, you know, ready to really scale this. And so, you know, I would say that we bet that was going to take 3 or 4 years, not 10 years, but still.
Yeah, no, well, so it sounds like it takes a village, right? You're pulling from different capabilities and software and what other people have done to sort of put something together. I think that's the magic when you're talking about data and information as opposed to, you know, straight wet chemistry and where you almost have to sort of by serially or brute force move forward as a, you know, in this data-driven world, you sort of if you see something somebody's doing and it's open source or it's available, you can just sort of pull it in.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I think you know, I think that's true on the data side. I think on the algorithm side, the gap was just too large. There really was nothing that we could even buy off the shelf. I mean, something as simple as you know, I have a 2D drawing of a compound and I need all of its low energy 3D conformations, which seems like a pretty easy problem. Even there, the off-the-shelf tools were insufficient to give us the guarantees that we needed for our level of modeling that we were going to do and our kind of modeling. And so, you know, really there was not much from a tool standpoint that was off the shelf, but, you know, we realized that if we had to solve some of the unsexy problems to then go after the really interesting machine learning problems, that it was going to be worth doing. And so we did. And I think that, again, when you think about the process as a whole, so our goal was not to have a bunch of tools that we would sell to a medicinal chemist sitting at Pfizer. Our goal was to have an AI-centered process where the input of the medicinal chemist and the biologist were incorporated in the right way without incorporating their bias. And that's, again, that's a very challenging right there, I think, is, you know, there's a there's probably an hour to talk about exactly how you do that, but it's a challenge, and one that's technology plus process plus just, you know, I think human willingness to give up control of certain parts of the process that have all come together to allow us to do this.
Well, you know, that brings me, you know, to the, you know, my description of when I was reading about the company a little bit is it a learning system the way that I described it in the intro? Does it loop into that back and forth to get you to a better outcome or a better answer or a better target?
Yeah, and for us, right, we are so focused on the chemical design itself. But if you think about it, right, so the answer is yes, because, you know, what we're doing really as a company is we learn, right? Every program we run, sure, we get smarter. But every round we run within a program, the models get better and better. And so, you know, I think just from a framework perspective here, right? ML, machine learning, is intrinsically interpolative, right? I have some data, I want to learn from that data, and then I want to predict something, right? But the problems we're trying to solve here are kind of the opposite, right? So what we're trying to do is I want a compound that does or does not get into the brain. I have no such examples. If I did, the problem would be solved. So how do I take, you know, I think, how do I orthogonalize these goals so that I make individual models of all the causes of success and failure and then apply them to the model or apply them to these spaces of chemistry, right? In a sense, if you think about the machine learning or the AI that everybody thinks about today, it's sort of, you know, it's looked at a bunch of pictures of a zebra and then it can pick out a zebra from a new photo, right? That's what I mean by, you know, it's interpolative, right? Whereas what we're trying to do when we approach a drug discovery problem is to evolve a new zebra that can survive in the Arctic. And that's just a much harder, right? That's what I mean by extrapolation.
That was good. That was good.
Yeah, so really, you know, what ends up happening, and I can maybe give you one practical example where we worked on a cardiovascular program with a partner, and actually this was a project where, and I think this is maybe, you know, this is a good example because it's a problem that you could not have approached without AI to unlock the chemistry. And the reason is it was a highly phenotypically driven program where what we had was a system which could follow fluxes of calcium inside the cell, which tell you, you know, for example, which happens once a second, hopefully, in everybody's heart, because it's what drives, right, the contraction of the heart muscles. And so you're trying to follow these fluxes within the cell itself, which means you can never really do a high throughput screen to test. So you have to just accept that your test here is going to be this low throughput sort of assay, which means the ability to then virtualize that assay and run a billion compounds through it becomes critical if you're trying to solve the multi-objective optimizations. And so we became interested in this program to go after the ranitidine receptor, where we ended up building a model, screening all available compounds, starting with really one patent of compounds that had been published, and we immediately found 24 new scaffolds of compounds that we then, you know, entered into a partnership with Servier and a small company called Armgo that they were already working with. And really at that point we're able to, I think, start what we think is the most important piece of this, which is how do I optimize the compounds. And so, for example, we characterized the compounds and we figured out that we had some off-target liabilities. And of course, at that point, we start to build models of those off-targets. And every round we do, those models get better and better. We figured out we had a metabolic stability issue. And again, same thing, right? We'd make some compounds and then we screen them, we test them against these targets in the lab or for stability in the lab. And so to give you an example there, we ended up doing three cycles every time feeding the data back in. And I think in 69 compounds basically completed, you know, the in vitro lead optimization. This is, again, one where once you're sort of, that's when you're done changing atoms and start pushing things into higher order models. But really, I think, you know, was a very nice example of what of what happens when you close the feedback loop where, you know, A, if you didn't have this technology, you never would have attempted this. And B, I think, you know, well, we have evidence that it probably would have taken thousands of compounds to get to a similar endpoint, not 60. So time
from start to finish is shorter than what you would normally take, cheaper or more cost effectively?
I think any kind of successful computer centered drug program, right, is going to have the advantages along all those axes. So in this particular case, we probably did it in, I don't know, a fifth the time, maybe a tenth the time, I think something like that. It's not exactly clear how long the parallel effort was going. You know, cost is somewhere in the 1/50th range, probably, maybe less. But I think the critical thing is this is a problem that a lot of companies were interested in, that they sort of saw as, you know, as one of these undruggable targets. How am I even going to find chemical matter for this? And I think that's what's very interesting. Now, we did not solve the initial problem of finding something that bound, but we were able to take that something, which was a very narrow set of chemistries, and really, you know, blow it out and actually solve the other very challenging aspect.
And so that probably results in some unique IP for you guys to file.
Correct. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's correct. So for us, it's very easy, right? The learning, in a sense, right, with IP, what's funny is, you know, is, right, the 2D drawing that ends up in a patent is really a chemist notation of some, you know, 3D shape and electrostatic field that compounds might occupy, right? And so it's you know, in a sense, the reason, the Marcouche structure that encodes what is patented and not is fairly independent from what is active and not, right? So it's very easy for us to learn from patents and then say, you know, come up with new chemical matter or fix the following flaws by looking at a much broader chemistry, which I think is the more interesting problem rather than just patent bust. I think, you know, broadly speaking, right, in this space, it seems like there's this tendency to say, well, I can't really predict the failure and success of compounds. So instead, what I'm going to do is I'm going to repurpose and tweak and patent bust, right? And I think that's fine. There's a really interesting business to be built there, for sure. But it's not going to fix the original problem that you talked about, which is, you know, how do we use AI to close the loop and get better at not failing? In a sense, what it's saying is I'll take the things that haven't failed, and then I'll start there so I don't have to worry about those problems. So you're sort of, you know, which again can generate a really valuable pipeline. There's companies doing that that are, you know, very, very interesting. You know, certainly Recursion or Benevolent come to mind. But at the end, and I know they're both getting more interested in doing more novel chemistries also. But ultimately, the question is, how do I model that stuff?
Yeah. How do you see AI changing drug discovery and development and clinical research? And I think about this and I think to myself, you know, how does it change the industry as a whole? Because if you're the ones identifying these compounds and filing the IP, you know, does that turn big pharma into just the final development and marketing side of the equation?
Aren't they kind of becoming this already anyway? I mean, it's sort of an interesting question, right? Which is, right, we're, as an industry, right, we're getting into, I mean, everybody's got this, the same graphics these days from, you know, Evalue Far, but the idea that we're now reaching the zero IRR moment for discovery, right? We're already below cost of capital, so that happened already, right? But now we're reaching zero IRR, where you're better off just, you know, not doing discovery at all. And so I think that's what's really interesting, is that it's not a question of, oh, look, AI is the latest shiny object that can create some assets that we can run the old model against. To me, you know, the reason we're reaching this, you know, this zero IRR moment on discovery is that we've essentially picked all the low-hanging fruit that the old approaches can pick, and we've gone, you know, big TA to smaller TA to smaller TA, and increasingly gone after, I think, less and less lucrative compounds, in a sense, right? And certainly, if you look at the level of segmentation that people are aiming for in the oncology market, right? That seems like that's the direction there too. And so How does AI fix that? Well, it kind of redefines what that low-hanging fruit is, right? If cardio is significantly less invested in than oncology, yet most people die from cardio, right, from CV problems. So why is it that our investment is not proportional to that? Well, because we have the channel blockers for arrhythmia, and they do okay, right? But yet we know that that's probably the largest unmet need globally. And in a sense, the point of AI is, at least in my view, is if you can redefine what that low-hanging fruit is, you can change where you actually place your bets. I mean, you know, if I think about the pharma process, right, 3 out of 4 times I make 2,000 compounds and I never get to a candidate, right? So if you just do the thought experiment and say, what if 3 out of 4 times I make 200 compounds and I get to the candidate? How does that change what I work on, when, what markets I go after, where I develop things, how I finance programs? Everything changes at that point.
Do you really believe they understand this? In other words, I find
there's an enlightened set of companies. What do you think?
I just find that, you know, if I have, you know, my kingdom, and it took me a lifetime to build my kingdom, and now, you know, it only takes a fraction of the number of people, et cetera, people don't like giving up their kingdoms, right?
But think about who would have said 10 years ago that WuXi would be doing more chemistry for Pfizer than Pfizer. And I don't actually know that that's true, but that's generally, it's just an illustrative point, right? That you would dismantle the actual chemistry organizations that were the core. That was the kingdom, right? Was we do chemistry best. These were old chemistry companies that became pharma companies, right?
But you said a 10-year period, right? I think about is the stuff that you're working on and that I'm looking at other companies is, the time frame is being squeezed dramatically. So the speed at which these people need to change is moving up very rapidly in my mind.
I don't think that every company will catch up to this. And I think my point is, if you think about this situation of the zero IRR, you have two choices, because there's no other mechanism other than AI to close the loop and actually change the numbers from the PHRMA site that haven't changed in 20 years, right? There's no other feedback loop. Humans can't do it. So there's no other way to learn from success and failure other than AI. And so my point is, it's not a nice to have shiny object in the corner. It's you either embrace it or you're Kodak. And I don't think they all will, because we interact with many of them. I think there's groups that really get it and it's also reflected in just how open they are to outside help on that, right? So there are companies that are putting, you know, redefining what pre-competitive data is, putting that in the public domain, because they're realizing that attacking the attrition problem is absolutely critical, right? If you think about some of what John Baldoni has done with Adam, for example, and what he's trying to do there, and there's other companies doing something similar in Europe. But I think there's a few enlightened groups that won't be Kodak, and that realize that will be critical.
So you know, you've been in around this space for a long time. How do you describe the landscape of companies involved in this field of AI and, say, therapeutic development?
Yeah, I mean, what's unique, right, for us here is we're focused on chemistry, and most chemistry data is not big data, right? I think where most of these companies have spawned is from the areas where there is big data, right? Genomics data, clinical data, where there really is around, I think, biology and omics, there is way more data to apply, I think, more standard types of approaches to make derivatives or derivatize more standard kinds of approaches, because you can assume, you know, very large amounts of data will be there, and relatively cheap generation of more data, right? Certainly not on the clinical side, but on the, you know, more on the omics side. Whereas for us, every experiment, right, if I need a PK data point, that's $1,000 for one data point. So there's a difference, I think, in what we're doing versus where most of the new companies have come out. And it makes sense that that's where most of them would be generated. Now, if I think about, you know, kind of that space, it's sort of, there's the NLP piece, which again, I think has some real value at teaching us about biology we missed or didn't realize connections we didn't realize were there. And, you know, companies like Benevolent are doing an interesting job of exploiting that, right? I think about, you know, some of the image-based work that a Recursion is doing, and I think that's also very interesting. You know, I think some of the kind of new Matty Tussar approaches are again, I think taking advantage of that web of biological data is something which is of a lot of value, right? And I think, you know, and then you have sort of what I think are the more structure-based methods, which I think are, you know, in a sense, it's great because but even if you get that piece right of structure-based drug design, for example, you're still only solving 10% of the problem, right? You still have a very traditional, you know, path forward. So in a sense, I think when I think about the landscape, my only issue is, are we really drinking our own Kool-Aid? Are we really thinking about, you know, about solving the attrition problems and about, you know, what that does and what we should be doing? Or are we saying, I have this little advantage and I'm going to exploit it to make a pipeline that, you know, of a couple of programs that I'll take forward, or I'm going to package this up as a little service? And I think there's a few companies that are thinking about the bigger picture, but certainly some of them seem to be, I would say, falling back into the old CAD services model for pharma, and that's, I think that's going to be problematic.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, it depends on, there's such a multifactorial issue to figure out who's going to survive and who's not. I mean, in my experience, or looking at things historically, big organizations don't morph that easy, and most of them cease to exist going forward. But so tell me, like, what are some of the businesses and, of course, technical challenges you face in your quest moving this forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think the business ones are, we started when nobody cared, right? So investors, you know, tech investors, we were too biotechy for them, and biotech investors, we weren't in phase two, so or you know, just funding a phase two program. So we had to come up with a pretty creative way, you know, DOD money, you know, service plus models to basically build and validate the platform. So which is, I think, that was the primary business challenge. You know, where we've ended up is the idea that that our model is centered around the value of the assets we generate, and we generate them for ourselves. And I think, you know, we primarily focus on CNS and cardio because those are areas that we think we uniquely unlock. And also with, in partnership with companies where really we price and structure the deals around, you know, if a candidate is worth $100 million and a lead is worth 25 and a hit is worth 5, you know, then how do you structure a deal so that you get your fair part of that value, you know, when the pharma also realizes that value. And so we have a mix of, I would say, an internal pipeline and an external pipeline that we run, but we don't do services. And the reason we can do this is because of the validation and because we've taken this, you know, long journey through business model space, I would say. I think that the technical challenges are quite different because they were, you know, initially it's just, we have to start from public data, and public data is a mess. It's noisy, it's biased, it's often wrong. So how do you deal with that? And really a lot of the techniques that we built to deal with the complexity, the noise, and the bias that is intrinsic in that data have allowed us to transfer what we've learned to ADME and tox prediction, for example, where a lot of the problems also manifest themselves. The problem with ADME and tox, and this is the technical challenge, is there's not enough data out there. The problems are more complex, and the data is of worse quality that is in the public domain. You know, so there's a bit of a chicken and egg problem, which is how do I develop, you know, unlike activity where I got access to all of the history, with ADME and tox, it's you know, how do I actually get the data to see if my stuff is working? And really there, it was the DOD for us that solved that chicken and egg problem, because we got almost $10 million in funding over the past few years from the DOD to build a predictive ADME and a predictive tox system, where now we have a prototype, which, you know, becomes much easier to collaborate with pharma around. So if you combine that with the AI spring, and as I mentioned, the enlightened few companies that are redefining what is pre-competitive, we're now getting access to significant amount of that siloed dark data that pharma, you know, we know is there but can't reach. And what we're seeing is just, you know, obviously a significant improvement in the performance of our general models for these phenomena. So really, you know, and of course having success there and giving people acts saying, you know, I built this data built these models with the data from these companies, makes it, you know, lowers the barrier for the next company to come in. And so that's certainly what we're seeing, is we're seeing some real momentum where next year we're going to be able to say Numerate's internal models for ADME and Tox were based on more data than any single pharma has in-house. And I think that's, you know, we're just on the cusp of that now, and hopefully we'll be able to say that next year.
So you're in the Bay Area, which is, you know, I think about it as the, you know, obviously it's a hotbed of technology, although it's getting so damn expensive, I think people are starting to move out of the Bay Area. How do you find the right people? I mean, these are not, you know, it's one thing to say, I'm going to get a computer scientist, but, you know, you need a computer scientist that understands the biological dynamics that are going on, one devoid of the other. And it, I think, you know, you set up for a lot of heartache and failure. So how do you staff? How do you keep your staff? How do you not lose them to Facebook or Google or Apple or anybody else?
Yeah, I think there's two challenges, right? I mean, there's challenges on both sides. I mean, it's how do you get, you know, the best medicinal chemists, and we've been very, very, very lucky there, right, to accept some guidance from the machine, and that's more than anything cultural on that side. I think the recruiting challenge on the tech side is real, and, you know, in a sense, will Numerate in the foreseeable future be able to outbid Google for an AI person? Probably not, right? But I don't think every person coming out of, you know, the AI labs and in Berkeley and Stanford and, you know, these other places is really happy optimizing the ad revenues, right? I think there's a set of people that is really interested in these types of problems and in making a difference, and it is absolutely hard to find them because, you know, most people can make more money faster jumping tech company to tech company than they will, you know, waiting for a drug to pay off. But they are there, and it's just a question of talking to enough people, I guess, is really been the issue. And, you know, once they're here, I think then it's just these problems are intrinsically so interesting and exciting. And what we really do is we don't have go-betweens between our teams. It's, you know, our AI folks have to learn enough about chemistry and biology to be able to speak directly with our medicinal chemists. And that takes real investment of time and effort on our part. And it's worth making to get that kind of half man, half machine working together properly.
It sounds like you guys are having an incredible journey. You know, you morph the model from pure services to now having your own molecules. What's next after that?
Yeah, I think, you know, what's interesting is the financing environment is changing, and I think the whole venture landscape has changed quite a bit, where there's less and less companies being started with the, you know, raise five, then you do a series B at 10 or 15, then you do, you know, then you make some money, and it's a lot more, you know, larger plays. And so really, I think what's, really what we want to do is capture a lot more of the value that we're generating. And so if right now we're selling our programs relatively early, we're now completing a financing round where we will be able to take things much further. And the idea is to generate both internally and externally a number of candidates, which we can then go fund either independently or as part of Numerate, or sell. And so, you know, in a sense, it's from a business standpoint, it's not necessarily narrowing down what we work on, you know, broadly, but internally, focusing on a small number of what we think are going to be very unique assets, primarily in CNS, because that's how you really demonstrate the value. On the partnering side, you know, the issue we have is we have more potential business than we probably want to do, because there's so many companies that want to try out this AI thing, and you know, many of course are a bit more sophisticated than that, but really we have to just, you know, think about, as we scale what we're doing, you know, where does exclusivity become a problem? Where does just the volume or how much we're giving up become a problem? So that's, you know, those are the challenges that are on our horizon in terms of balancing our internal and external pipeline. But, you know, certainly the taking things further there. And from a technical standpoint, really the next steps are to include more and more human data in our at drug design time. So right now, you know, we have some, you know, I think very interesting ways of modeling preclinical ADMEAN tox, but ultimately, right, we're not curing the rats. So how do we remove as much as possible the idea that we're building models of models and actually build the models of humans and then use the preclinical models to kind of guide whether we're right or not, rather than, you know, so I think those are, you know, that's what's on our horizon the next 2 or 3 years.
Well, that sounds, all of those sounds like, you know, first world, wonderful challenges to have in front of you. It's not lack of funding or other issues that you're sort of scraping and dealing with as you were maybe in the early days.
Sure. Yeah. No, for sure. It's very different. And I think the landscape will change. I mean, you know, there are some very large rounds that are going to be done in this space, and I think probably some consolidation that'll happen also, you know, in this space in the next few years, where it won't be, you go to an AI conference and there's, you know, the usual 10 little companies, and they're kind of, you know, hoping somebody funds them and hoping somebody gives them a project. I think that kind of that dynamic will change quite a bit. That's my, you know, just given what I'm saying.
No, and I was thinking, you know, we're, you know, there's different pieces of data that I think people are working on, and I was just imagining, what if you took a few of, you know, one or two of, you know, different ones and sort of got them to merge in a way, and, you know, all of a sudden you've got way more firepower than any pharma that I know of that's out there right now.
Correct. Yeah, no, I agree. I think the thing that pharma still has is that historical data, and also this, you know, I think the history of computer-aided drug design or AI-driven drug design now is just littered with companies that underestimated the complexity of the biology, and, you know, it's sort of, there's a lot of skulls in that desert, right, and of the problem, and so to me, right, that expertise of what is a drug versus what is, you know, an active compound or, you know, some preclinical, you know, early asset, you know, that is something that pharma has and will continue to have for a while. I think the idea is, you know, how do you feed that pharma development and commercialization engine with the best possible assets? And then maybe there's deals you do that are, you know, that are a little bit different, a little bit broader with pharma at that point. For now, you know, just hopefully you can have an engine that generates assets for them to take forward and just be paid, you know, for the equivalent value that, you know, if a biotech that didn't have AI had sold them the same asset. But I think, you know, ultimately that piece, you know, pharma just has too much of that expertise is my view. And if we scale, you know, I mean, sure, I think there will be some, you know, AI-centered pharmas. Maybe some pharmas will morph, or maybe some AI companies will morph into a pharma. But you know, that skill set still needs to exist, and pharma has it.
Well, I know you have to go catch a plane. I don't want to take up any more of your time. So, thank you for joining us here on the show. And, you know, I wish you and all the others in the space great success. I mean, I'm not getting any younger. So the faster we get to, better therapeutics to take care of people like me, the happier we all be. So thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me and for the interest you're helping maintain in the space. So thank you.
And that's it for this episode. Join me for the next episode of this special series of AI, machine learning, and analytics applied to drug discovery and development, where I speak to Woot Brusselers, who is the CEO and founder of DeepSix AI. We'll discuss the question, what if utilizing technology allows us to find patients for clinical trials in minutes rather than months? If you enjoyed Moneyball Medicine, please head over to iTunes to subscribe, rate, and leave a review. It is greatly appreciated. Hope you join us next time. Until then, farewell.